In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Following the horrors of the First World War, people around the world set out to create perfect societies, with very mixed results. Anna Nima charts their efforts in her new book, The Utopians, Six Attempts to Build the Perfect Society. BBC History Magazine's deputy editor, Matt Elton, spoke to Anna to find out more.
So your book, The Utopians, is about attempts to build a sort of a perfect or alternative society. Given all the news that's going on about climate change, pandemics, that kind of things, I wondered, did you start work on this before the pandemic kicked off, or was it during all the events we've witnessed in the past sort of 18 months?
No, this book has very, very long roots. I started it as a PhD, just working on one of the six communities, Dartington Hall, set up in Devon. So that was long before the pandemic started, 4 or 5 years. But obviously it did acquire like much more resonance as I was working on it in the last little bit. And I I didn't want to put too much about the pandemic in because I didn't want it to sort of become a kind of contemporary piece. And I thought that a huge amount is being written about the pandemic anyway. But it did make me think a lot about the way that cataclysmic sort of world events affect people. And actually, there's a sort of kind of interesting contrast between the contemporary pandemic and the flu pandemic in 1918, which happened just before all of my communities were set up, in that I think the pandemic in 1918 is estimated to have killed over 50 million people, perhaps even 100 million people. And the COVID pandemic is hovering around sort of just upwards of 4 million. So actually it's a sort of, in a way, a much smaller scale event. And obviously we haven't really sort of seen the fallout of it particularly, but there definitely do seem to be kind of a lot more impetus to change how people are living. And there's also the kind of intersection of the pandemic of 1918 with the First World War, and then the contemporary pandemic and global warming sort of becoming a much more kind of imminent problem. And it's kind of remains to be seen how those kind of different events are going to affect people. But I think that there's quite a lot of eco-communes being set up, or eco-communities being set up at the moment, or sort of strengthening at the moment. So I wonder if that's going to be kind of our contemporary wave of utopias, in the same way that the utopias I wrote about were much more about kind of pacifist and fulfilling living rather than ecology.
Hmm. So to situate for listeners sort of when this book is exploring, it's covering the years between sort of 1920s and 1940s. To what extent were all the utopias you talk about in this book formed as a result of the trauma of the First World War?
I would say that they all were, but in very different ways. The communities I write about, one is in India, one is in Japan, one is in England, one is in Germany, one is in France, and one is in America. And all of those countries had really different experiences in the war. India was sort of, the community I write about was partly a sort of, it wasn't nationalist exactly, but it was partly in response to sort of the way that India was treated and sort of exploited in the First World War. And so it was a sort of effort to create a sort of self-sufficiency, independent of the British. And then I write about a community which was set up in Germany, sort of in the wake of the German defeat in the First World War, and that sort of came out of, in an odd way, the same place as Nazism or the kind of wave of communism that there was in Germany. But the community I write about was very Christian. And then there are later communities. I write about one which was set up in America just around the beginning of the Second World War, but it was set up by somebody whose brother died in the First World War. So sort of that had a very long tail of effect of people continuing to seek better ways of being. So I would say they definitely were all pretty closely related to the war, which just had, you know, it shaped the lives of everyone who lived through it for the rest of their lives, I think.
So let's start talking about the different examples in your book. One of them that's particularly interesting is Dartington Hall, which I believe you've got a personal connection to. Is that right?
Yes, my family has a farm next door to Dartington Hall, and I was sort of brought up between there in the summer holidays and living in London when I was at school. And so I sort of observed it from afar, and it was regarded slightly askance by local farmers because it was a place where Londoners came up to sort of get their cultural kicks, and also a place where sort of alternative types would sort of swim naked in the river or perform dances and mimes. And so I wasn't really brought up really much of an understanding of what it was doing. And I have sort of gradually discovered that and become much more impressed by it. So yeah, no, I do have a personal connection with it. And that was sort of an experimental community which was set up in 1925 by a Yorkshire squire called Leonard Elmhurst, who married an American heiress who was originally from the Whitney family, who made a huge amount of money with a sort of monopolies over New York railroad cars. And she married first a man who died in the influenza pandemic in 1918. And then she met Leonard Elmhurst and remarried. And they were both sort of these extremely idealistic types who had suffered a lot in the fallout from the First World War and wanted to model a new way of living. And so they bought this rundown estate in Devon and sort of began to do that there.
And what would we have experienced if we were to have visited during this period?
It's interesting. It would have depended. If you had visited very early on, you would have sort of arrived to a great hall with no roof and pigs rootling around in the courtyard of this kind of wonderful medieval hall. It was originally given by Richard II to his half-brother as a gift, and was sort of a grand place that gradually got more and more dilapidated through the centuries. And you would have found Dorothy and Leonard Elmhurst sort of attempting to live in state in the hall, and a small number of us of idealistic people who were working with them. And that would have been the sort of beginnings of not particularly impressive looking beginnings. And there would have been a small number of children running around getting this progressive education. But then if you arrived in the 1930s, it became this internationally renowned centre for progressive living and for the arts. And a large number of people who sort of fled from the Nazi regime in Germany and in other sort of surrounding countries sort of ended up at Dartington. So there was a sort of huge ballet company, and Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus, came and designed a bit of the theatre, and lots of people would sort of take the train up from London at the weekends to take part in the kind of various activities going on there. So Dartington was very much about leaving the sort of capitalistic nexus and finding a more holistic, sort of all-round fulfilling way for people to live that was also much more cooperative. So it was trying to combine a life where people had sort of creativity, they had a sort of much more progressive education that lasted from the cradle to the grave, and they did have work. There was economic work was a part of it, but it was all pretty experimental and didn't make very much money. Fortunately, they had Dorothy Elmhurst's vast fortune to rely on, so they didn't have to make too much money. It was sort of this constantly changing but extremely vibrant fabric of people experimenting with radical ideas about how best to live.
I'm fascinated by, and it's a recurring theme of your book, about the kind of people that set up these kind of communities. What do we know about Dorothy Elmhurst, who you just mentioned particularly, and to what extent does this community reflect the ideals of its founders?
I'm extremely fond of Dorothy Elmhurst after having spent many years studying her, and I'm particularly fond of her because amongst all the people who I write about who set up these communities, there are very few women who have influence. Like, there are many women in the communities themselves, but there are very, very few women who are sort of leading them. And I think Dorothy Elmhurst is the exception, in part because she was extremely wealthy, and in part because she was extremely determined to use her wealth in a good way. And she came to Dartington in her late 30s, having sort of spent the early part of her life engaged in various different forms of experimental philanthropy. And I think that probably represents a lot of the other people who set up these communities. For instance, Rabindranath Tagore, who's this Nobel-winning poet and social reformer, he set up a community in Bengal called Shantiniketan, Shriniketan, when he was in his 60s. And he had sort of tried lots of other routes for improving society before that. And so I think there was a certain characteristic in all of these idealistic men and women who end up abandoning everything about their everyday lives to set up one of these communities is that constant questing and dedication to the idea that there is a better way of being lived to discover.
Despite having this sort of female figure at its head, is it right to say that this community, however, wasn't particularly sort of open to feminist ideals, or that it still reflected, I suppose, the sort of patriarchal structure of society at the time?
Yes, I don't think any of the communities I write about, including Dartington, had a particularly sort of feminist forward approach to living. I would say that the sort of feminist urge of the time seemed to have gone much more into sort of mainstream campaigning for expanded suffrage or expanded social rights, and that the sort of act of seceding from society to build a utopia didn't really make sense if you were still at the point of trying to gain more of a foothold in society as a woman. So that in a way, none of these communities had a particularly sort of progressive role for women. And when you look at the Bruderhof community, which was set up in Germany and was attempting to model itself on the early church, the role of women is much more limited. Again, they end up sort of dressing very conservatively in sort of long skirts and headscarves and taking much less of a role than men in guiding the direction of the community. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to say that there's nothing sort of experimental in gender roles. For instance, Dartington became this sort of sanctuary for various gay people in the 1930s, including Mark Toby, an American artist, and Gerald Hurd. Some of them were sort of out and out gays. Some of them were just didn't talk about it. For instance, Gerald Hurd sort of didn't really come out as gay until much later in America, sort of in public circles, although he was in private circles. So there were sort of progressive elements in that area of sort of gender relations. But yes, I wouldn't say that these were communities where the role of women was sort of excitingly progressive.
And how was this community viewed by the community around it, by society at large, I suppose?
Well, it depends how widely you look. I think locally, Dartington attracted a great deal of opprobrium. This was a period where Britain was largely Christian, and the Elmhursts, Leonard Elmhurst, who was also founded Dartington, originally trained as a vicar and then lost his faith in the First World War. Two of his brothers died fighting, and he believed that the church had sort of supported the war, and so this completely destroyed his desire to become a vicar. And so they rejected all Christian teaching, which infuriated the sort of conservative elements in local society, and people wouldn't send their locals wouldn't send their children to Dartington School, some of them, because of that kind of lack of Christian teaching. And there were sort of rumors that black magic was occurring at Dartington, and it was a sort of a place of evil. There's a church that was and still is situated just beyond the kind of boundaries of Dartington, and the vicar there was particularly conservative and would sort of preach against the Elmhursts, and his church became a sort of a place where people who opposed the estate could congregate. So it did really have a very bad local reputation. But nationally and internationally, sort of in progressive circles, it became this really, really important kind of collecting point for people who wanted to do new things with their lives. And that was partly because it had a lot of money, and partly because the Elmhursts were very kind of capacious and inclusive in their sort of view of how this sort of better life should be lived. And really it was about sort of enabling other people to live out their ideas as well as executing their own. And I think in a funny way, Dartington has sort of remained with this kind of slightly difficult relationship with the local community, but also remained very important in sort of wider circles. And the other communities had, to varying degrees, perhaps quite a similar sort of relationship with the surrounding countryside, because they were all rural communities. And also were sort of flagships in the wider progressive movement.
We should talk about some of those other communities that you explore in your book. What other communities did you pick, and what do they tell us about this period, I suppose?
I mean, it was interesting choosing the communities. I did my PhD on Dartington, and so that led me to two of the communities. One was set up by Tagore in India, and Leonard Elmhurst, who set up Dartington, had been with Tagore in the early 1920s, sort of helping him set up his community. And another community set up in Japan called Atarashikimura, or the New Village, which was set up by a Japanese novelist called Mushukunoji Sanetsu, was indirectly inspired by Tagore, who traveled to Japan as part of his sort of Nobel laureate-winning international tour. So those and those three all have a sort of certain similarity in being a lot about holistic fulfillment, sort of the head, the heart, and the hand, stepping away from a capitalism and towards cooperation. So I suppose I sort of those three have that sort of similarity, but obviously the experience of Japan, an independent country, Britain, which was a sort of colonial, I suppose, in some ways, and India, which was a colonized nation, were all very different. And then the other three communities I look at, I suppose, are united by having a sort of certain spiritual or religious strand. And obviously, this was an interesting era in terms of religious change and the sort of movement away from a sort of Christian status quo. I wouldn't say towards any form of secularism, but certainly towards sort of more questing and interest in alternatives. The Bruderhof community, which was set up in Germany, was about, I suppose, reforming the church and stepping away from mainstream Christianity, but towards a sort of more pure version, which was not about the sort of conventional infrastructure of the church, but which was about living in the spirit of the Bible. And then the other two communities I look at came from this very different strand of a kind of zeitgeist, I suppose, which was about spiritualism and developing a sort of a new approach to life, a new spiritual approach to life, which to some degree combined the social sciences and psychology, but perhaps not in very scientific ways.
Hmm. Let's talk about Bruderhof there, which you mentioned there, which was the sort of utopia that aimed to put the Bible's teaching into a real place. How did they do that, and how did it go?
Well, I have occasionally, in discussing this book with people, sort of been criticized for being a bit too much of an advocate for the Bruderhof community, in that I would say they were quite successful in doing what they intended to do, and much more successful than some of the other communities. They had this very clear blueprint for what they wanted to do in the Bible, in the early church, in the Bible, sort of Jesus' disciples following him, and the way that they behaved. They lived in a community of goods. They shared everything that they had. The Bruderhof did that. The trouble with a lot of the other communities I write about is they didn't really have a sort of manifesto for what they wanted to do. And it was very easy, particularly once the sort of charismatic founders lost their charisma or died, to sort of lose track of quite what they were planning to do, whereas the Bruderhof community didn't have that problem. And they started off as a very small group of people following this man who was first trained as a preacher called Eberhard Arnold and his wife, Emmy, who was equally important in founding the community. And they continue today, 100 years later, more than 100 years later, as I think there are 23 communities now all across the world. I think there's around 3,000 people living in these communities, and they're following pretty much the same sort of blueprint as they were in the 1920s. And to me, that's quite impressive in a feat. I mean, as a feat, I think that there's a certain sometimes incompatibility between idealism and competence, or there can be. The two don't always go together. And I would say that that's probably been the case in the people I've read about. And I think the Bruderhof community sort of demonstrate something different. The founders didn't have very much money when they began, and I think that was very helpful for them, and was quite different to the other communities I write about, which were set up often by elite people with a fairly large sum of money at their command. So they had to sort of work out how to be economically sustainable early on. Which meant they could keep going, and are sort of still going now, and are kind of financially viable. And they definitely had a very bad time in that they started off in Germany. They were persecuted by the Nazis. They ended up in Liechtenstein, and then in Britain, and then in Paraguay, and then in America. So they sort of it was tough going. But they did keep going. None of which is to say that I think the Bruderhof community is a sort of blueprint for a perfect society. I went to stay with them, one of the communities in Sussex, which was incredibly interesting in terms of the experience of living with people who are living out their social ideals, which are totally different to sort of mainstream social ideals, but was quite shocking in terms of the abnegation of sort of individual responsibility and choice. You sort of did really what you were told, and there was a timetable from dawn to dusk, and also the sort of gender dynamics were quite different to the outside world, and I found them quite difficult. They were sort of, the women's roles were viewed fairly conservatively, they dress conservatively, they tend to marry early and have children, and not to be as involved in the day-to-day guidance of the community as the men.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I do think that some of the people who joined the communities had difficult things happen to them or difficult lives, and did want to sort of subsume themselves to something bigger than themselves. And so there was a certain loss of self, which a lot of these communities offered.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal. So why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
What was the manifesto of this community?
I would say that it was about manifesting God's kingdom on earth in as much as possible. So it's about living in Christian brotherhood, I suppose. And that meant sharing things. And they were interesting because they didn't really want to sort of convert the world necessarily, but they wanted to sort of work with other people in the world who had a similar philosophy, whether they were actually Christian or not. It was sort of, quite strongly influenced by the socialist movement. I think they sort of aren't necessarily particularly strongly supportive of the label, but probably sort of Christian socialism is one kind of broader way of categorizing them.
Heading from Germany to France, another of your chapters focuses on the incredibly named Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man. Can you talk us through what that means and when this particular community was established?
Well, this was established by a fellow called G.I. Gurdjieff, who was an extremely flamboyant and possibly quite sinister Greek Armenian, who was probably the only one of the utopians who I write about in my book who I ended up not having a great deal of sympathy for. He was born sort of on the edge of the Russian Empire and wrote a book about sort of going wandering in the desert for several decades and acquiring spiritual wisdom that way, and gradually eventually sort of turned up as this sort of guru or leader of this spiritual system he called the Fourth Way, which at its heart had a sort of idea of shocking people out of their machine-like state into a sort of full consciousness, or waking them up. There are lots of different ways that he wrote about it. And he ended up writing several, I would say, slightly incomprehensible but also interesting books about his spiritual system. And he was in Russia during the revolution in 1917 and acquired a lot of followers who were just so shaken up by this that they thought it was necessary to sort of find a new way to live. And then, of course, the sort of fallout from the First World War had the same sort of psychological effect on lots of people, where they really wanted to believe in something different. And he tried to settle in England. He wanted to sort of set up a stronghold where he could sort of evangelize his spiritual system. And the British government he wanted to set up a community in Hampstead, and the British government wouldn't allow him there, as you can probably understandably. By this point, he had acquired a quite motley following of different nationalities. So he ended up in the woods of Fontainebleau, just outside Paris, in an old priory. And he turned this into a stronghold for his system, and it had a sort of garden and a little farm, and it attracted an astonishing range of people, including Catherine Mansfield, the New Zealand novelist who died of tuberculosis there. And I think a lot of people sort of suggested that Gurdjieff killed her, but I don't think that was the case. He is sort of an exception amongst the people I write about, because I think that he probably could be classed as a sort of cult leader as much as a utopian, in that his system sort of didn't really work without him, and it was his magnetic personality which sort of made it make sense. Although he does have a large number of followers up to the present day. When I was researching the Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man in the British Library, there were these little red cards in many of the books about him that sort of fell out, that were sort of advertising belonging to various Gurdjieffian societies. And when I was trying to get images for the book, I also sort of ran into a certain amount of opposition from people who didn't really believe that I was painting him in a very good light, which was, from their point of view, probably true.
So he's a classic example of a charismatic figure whose influence we can still feel reaching through the decades, even today. You mentioned that one of his aims was to shock people out of their complacency. What sort of methods did he use to do that?
I mean, anything he could think of, really. For instance, he would require people to dig ditches all the way across the sort of beautiful garden of the priory, and then the next day he would tell them to sort of fill the ditch back in again. Or he would get people to grow flowers, and then would drive the few sort of skinny cows from the farm across the flower beds. He was supposed to have taken a, I can't remember, religious leader, I don't know, maybe perhaps a bishop, into this sort of little sauna that he built. Actually, you can still see the remnants of it in the grounds of the priory today. And he stripped off and showed himself to the bishop. And, basically anything went, I think, in terms of waking people up. But of course, there seems to be a certain kind of symbiosis between his character, which was someone who liked shocking people, and this spiritual system that he created, which was also about shocking people. And I think he was also just extremely mean to people, which is, people weren't expecting. But I suppose the really extraordinary thing about him is that he did, attract people from across the world to his cause. So there must have been something there. And I think this is one of those instances which sort of do happen as a historian, where you can sort of feel the echoes of someone's personality down through time, but you can't totally capture it yourself. You don't know exactly what it was that drew people to him. And also, I think it was partly a product of the times and people being so uncertain, and him having a sort of certainty, which was really very impressive.
That's really interesting, because it's also quite hard for me in that particular case to get into the mindset of somebody who would want to go to that kind of community where I'm just doing seemingly pointless tasks. Do you think that there is a mindset common among the kinds of people who would attend these communities or join these communities, despite their geographical diversity?
I think that there are certain commonalities, but I don't think there's one sort of particular type. Like, I do think that some of the people who join the communities had difficult things happen to them or difficult lives, and did want to sort of subsume themselves to something bigger than themselves. And so there was a certain loss of self, which a lot of these communities offered, particularly something like the Bruderhof community or actually Tribeca College in California, which placed a lot of emphasis on, oh, there all these metaphors were used of used being a log who's needed to sort of join the fire in order that the fire burnt brighter, that kind of thing. So that was one sort of thing. But then I think that there was just this sort of broad sort of feeling after the First World War that something new was needed that really did encompass a huge number of people. And I don't think was particularly, you know, I don't think you could particularly attribute it to them being a certain type so much as that this was just this kind of world-shakingly awful time when it felt like continuing as you had gone before wasn't right. And so anything that really was going ahead with trying to model a new way was very attractive. That was a wide appeal.
I'm also really interested, you say in your book that this is a period that's often talked about in terms of nation scale political and social experiments. So fascism, I suppose, is one really extreme example, but there's lots of others. Whereas these are more sort of individual or community based attempts to do the same sort of thing. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think it was a sort of the elephant in the room when I was writing my book was sort of what is a utopia, and is fascism or communism a sort of utopian project in the same way that the ones that I'm looking at are? And I just thought that I had to sort of look at them as completely sort of separate things. These are sort of very small groups of idealists who are trying to turn their social dream into a real community, and they're using the fabric of their own lives to do it on a small scale, and they don't have any sort of forceful proselytizing ambitions. They hoped that they were going to model these sort of, you know, in a very gentle style, to sort of model these communities and hope that it would revolutionize the world, but not that they were going to force other people to sort of follow the same blueprint. So I think that the sort of large scale social reform movements like fascism came from sort of the same historical nexus of needing something new, but I think that the sort of the type of urge that we're talking about was very different.
Are there any other individuals who we've not talked about who we probably should?
I think that Gerald Hurd is a very interesting character who sort of threads his way through this book. He was at Dartington Hall in the 1920s and 1930s, and he set up this thing called the generating cell there, which was about creating a sort of spiritual link between everyone, between groups of generating cells around the world, which was going to prevent there being another war, because there was going to be this sort of networked intercommunication of harmony. And he became furious with Dartington because he didn't think it was sort of radical enough, and ended up leaving and taking part in the peace pledge movement in London for a bit. And then he decided that as the Second World War was coming and the whole of Europe was going to get blown up, he was going to move to America. He was a BBC science correspondent for a while, so he sort of had strong views on what science was going to do in war. And then he set up this community called Tribeca College in just outside Los Angeles, which was the smallest community I write about, and it lasted the shortest time. But it's extremely interesting for its sort of long tail into the counterculture of the 1960s. So it was combining Western and Eastern religions and some element of science or psychology, and trying to sort of turn people into the sort of pacifist leaders of men. He called them Brahmins or neo-Brahmins, who are sort of going to go out and lead the world to sort of spiritual union. Sounds quite mad, but he lived on after his community closed in 1947, and with Aldous Huxley, who was a big supporter of Tribeca College, he sort of became a leader of the counterculture, and sort of would sort of preach his ideas of sort of synthesis between East and West, and they became advocates of using LSD to sort of fuse your mind to the universal consciousness. And he probably a bit like G.I. Gurdjieff seems to have been a very magnetic man. But when you read his letters, they seem not nonsensical, but a stream of consciousness, a bit of a stream of consciousness there in terms of the logic.
Can we, and this might be a stretch, can we see connections between figures such as him particularly and the sort of darker characters of people like Charles Manson when we think about the cults that emerge from the counterculture in America?
I find that question quite difficult to answer. I think it's interesting. There seems to be a whole science of sort of cults. What is a cult? Who is a cult leader? And I didn't really know a great deal about that. I mean, I think these people I look at did come out of a moment of great historical trauma and had often suffered in whatever way themselves. Like, for instance, Gerald Hurd was also training to be a vicar. Seems to be a bit of a commonality amongst many of my protagonists. And his brother died in the war, and he had a complete mental breakdown. And after that, he sort of saw his role in life as being to sort of find a better way for himself and for mankind. He was also gay, and I think that his sort of repressed homosexuality was kind of a big issue in his sort of discontent with the world as it was, and his sense of needing to find something else. And I feel like that emergence out of a particular historical juncture perhaps is a little bit different to some of the sort of latter day cults, because people were jolted into that by wider forces rather than simply wanting adoration and attention. And in a way, Gerald Hurd was quite reclusive. And when he set up his community, part of the problem was all he wanted to do was sit in his room and read his books. And he didn't really want to kind of provide the day-to-day leadership and the sense of telling everyone what to do and what to eat that actually a lot of people who joined the community craved. So I think perhaps there's not that much of a similarity, but... I mean, I'm sure some people could draw threads.
If I was to finish this interview and go and set up my own kind of utopian society, what three things should I focus on to make sure it worked? Are there sort of key things that you think are really important ingredients?
Yes, definitely. I think, although I would be reluctant to join a community myself, having spent a long time reading about the wrangles that people have during them, there are certainly things that one could do that would make it work better. I think having a manifesto of some kind is very important, a written manifesto. And I think some of the communities I wrote about, like Atarashi Kimura in Japan, they had a 6-point manifesto called The Spirit of Atarashi Kimura. And they have a communal hall where this was sort of nailed up outside. And in fact, the community still exists. It had to move from southern Japan to just outside Tokyo. And you can just go and see this Spirit of Atarashi Kimura still nailed up there. And I think that just stops communities losing track of where they're going once their founders die. I think it has to be not too detailed, because obviously you need to sort of change to meet the changing historical challenges of your time. But I do think something is important. And then I think it's important to have a sustainable economic model of some kind. I think that it's very problematic when communities are set up by rich people who don't need to concentrate on doing that to begin with. And often utopian communities are about sort of seceding from capitalism, but you can't really do that without thinking of some possible alternative. The Rabindranath Tagore and G.I. Gurdjieff, two of the people I write about, just ended up asking for money over and over again as the way of keeping their community going. Dartington Hall in Devon had the sort of Whitney Elmhurst fortune behind it, and it's has really suffered since that fortune has it got left with an endowment, but it didn't really know how to make that endowment not sort of whittle away too quickly. And then probably one more thing which is very useful is a very clear decision-making process that doesn't rely on one person. Atarashi Kimura had a sort of very democratic decision-making process, which often meant that they didn't get much done because they were constantly at an impasse, but it sort of was there. Whereas somewhere like G.I. Gurdjieff's Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man just sort of had him dictatorially saying what should happen from above. And he was in a car crash sort of halfway through the life of the community and was stuck in a coma for a while, and nothing happened in the community apart from everyone waiting outside his door after he fell unconscious. So yeah, I think there's probably a manifesto, a good decision-making process, and some sort of sustainable economic model are all very important. But I think that probably all these communities do end up having a lot of internal friction.
And is it that eventually means some of the examples or some other examples come to an end? Can we chart sort of the end of the heyday of these sorts of kind of ways of living?
I think that two things bring them to an end, and it's not exactly internal wrangling. I think money actually does end up being a very important thing, because if you don't have money, you simply can't turn ideals into practice. Some money is required to do that. But also, utopian communities are inspired by the problems of their time. And I think once those problems make way for other problems, unless the communities sort of change their focus, they lose their importance. So Atarashii Kimura is very interesting because it was founded at a point when the Japanese government was really trying to kind of mobilize and modernize Japan. And so it was trying to impose this sort of idea that everyone would sacrifice themselves for wider society. And Atarashii Kimura is the only community I look at which is about the I and the importance of individualism. And that was because it was sort of reacting against this wider social philosophy. And although there's a certain sort of continuation of that in Japan, it's not really the sort of overriding thing now. So although Atarashii Kimura still exists, it's sort of, I think there's about 17 octogenarians who live there now. And it doesn't really, I mean, it's interesting in terms of its sort of low carbon footprint, and I think it has and it's sort of communitarian. It does have a communitarian element despite the individualism, but it doesn't, it's not so relevant to kind of contemporary society. And so there was a moment in the 1920s where there's sort of new village craze across Japan where people were trying to set up communities imitating Atarashii Kimura, but now of course they aren't, because it's just not relevant to the problems of the time. So yeah, I think times change and the communities become less relevant, and I think the communities run out of money, and one of those two things are usually what do them in the end.
So it's that they're banged up in their particular sort of historical context. Do you think that the communities you study in this book have any lessons for us at this particular historical moment?
I think they do and they don't. I think that the sort of humane lifestyle that they were aspiring towards, which was about cooperation and about not being too materialistic, continue to be very important. And I think they continue to be values which run in opposition to the mainstream. So I think that I could say something broad like that. And then I think that they demonstrate that we don't have to just sort of sit back and accept the status quo, that people can choose to dedicate themselves to experiments, to how to live better on a small scale. And they will have an influence, even if that's also on a small scale. So I suppose that they're sort of demonstrations of possibility. And each of the communities did have sort of wider effects, and some of them quite sort of dramatically wider effects, like the Elmhurst at Dartington were kind of very focused on making the arts available to everybody. And they eventually conducted an inquiry into arts in Britain. And this kind of fed into the creation of the Arts Council. So it sort of had an effect on the state. And then Tagore created this education system, which was about practical education as well as academic education. So it was something which was of more relevance to village children than an elite education system would be. And M.K. Gandhi went to stay at his community and was very inspired by this, and created a national system of education, which also had a sort of very practical element. Sort of you'd have your couple of hours of learning maths and literature, and then you would go off and learn how to milk a cow or to bottle fruit. And so I think that the communities sort of do indirectly demonstrate that these small experiments outside the mainstream can have wider effects.
And that these experiments have effects that seep into wider society, is that right?
Not completely. They are to a degree refuges and escapes, and they are often the privilege of the wealthy or the sort of people who sort of can afford to separate themselves off from society. But I do think that they can and sometimes do have an impact on wider society in a quite intangible way.
Finally, you mentioned there that you've had some experience of kind of going to visit these communities as well as just researching them. What were the things that most surprised you in the course of writing this book?
I mean, I suppose as a historian, you spend most of your time reading words on paper. I think that the experience of visiting the communities was surprising in terms of the sort of connection to the tangible sort of practicality of efforts in the past to improve society. Like, I loved going to stay with the Bruderhof community because you woke up at dawn, you sat around a kitchen table and sang Bruderhof hymns, and then you went into a workshop and you assembled wooden toys for most of the day. And I think that I was surprised by how I felt so emotionally connected to the people who set up the communities that I write about. And my my grandfather actually was a farmer in Devon, and when he retired, he set up this sort of tiny eco-commune by the sea in Devon. And I really hated being taken there as a child. It was quite scummy. It was all about sort of demonstrating how you can live a very low carbon lifestyle. So he would sort of lived in one room and lined it with insulated boards, and he burnt one log on the fire and didn't think you needed to live above 18 degrees C. So it was really cold in the winter, and he turned the fridge off, so the milk was off. And it was generally sort of, there was a lot of arguments between the various people he lived with. I think it was only as I grew older, and partly as I'd studied these communities, that I sort of connected the kind of mundane minutiae of day-to-day struggles with these kind of much broader kind of sweeping ideals. I suppose the sort of the physical reality of what life would have been like for the people in these communities was something which I only really got by a combination of, I guess, my grandfather's example and visiting not all the communities sort of continue in their physical form, but you can visit the places where they were set up at least and get that sense of day-to-day life.
That was Anna Nima. Her book, The Utopians, Six Attempts to Build the Perfect Society, is out now, published by Picador. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on a new history textbook that's shining a light on the slave trade.